You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Lily Ledbetter sought legal action against her employer, Goodyear, she was simply seeking the money owed to her for nearly two decades of work. And although, due to legal technicalities, she never will receive that amount, her story inspired the Lily Ledbetter Fair Pay Restoration Act, a 2009 law that allows women to fight to ensure that they will not be required to do the same jobs as their male counterparts for less money. Ms. Ledbetter tells her story with the help of Lanier Scott Isom in a new memoir called Grace and Grit, My Fight for Equal Pay and Fairness at Goodyear and Beyond. It's published by Crown Archetype, and I'm very pleased to welcome Lily Ledbetter to our show today. Hello.
Thank you. I am indeed honored to be here.
You grew up in a place much smaller than New York, Possum Trot, Alabama. How big was it?
Not very big at all. It was just a rural country section, one of the poorest sections of the state.
Was it near the Goodyear plant?
Yes, sir. It was probably within 35 miles of the Goodyear plant.
You're right that although you never went hungry when you were growing up, there wasn't much money available for anything beyond the necessities. What did that mean to you as a child? Did you feel deprived?
Well, when I got into school, I felt like I was lacking some things, but until then, I didn't know any different. But my friends who their fathers worked at Goodyear at the time, their families would get new automobiles every 3 years, and they had bought ready-made clothes, and mine were made out of feed sacks by my mother. And you know, I felt like I was deprived of some things, but yet, you know, we had basics, and that was it.
Well, you had the food that you grew.
That's true. We had our food.
You had a good friend, Sandra, whose father worked at Goodyear. She was one of those kids who was a lot more privileged than you. Is that what got you thinking that someday you might want to work at Goodyear?
Well, that was a possibility. That was a thought, yes.
But you actually had other jobs. You were working as an accountant at H&R Block, and you left that to work at Goodyear in a factory?
Well, I did, but Goodyear Tire Rubber in Gadsden, that factory was built originally in 1929, and when 1976 they built a new plant added out front called the Radial Tire Division, and they were going to implement a new management philosophy within the radial division, and I wanted to be a part of that because it was going to be a team concept.
But hadn't you heard stories about tensions between management and the unions?
Oh, yes, and there had been a lot of strikes, and there had been a lot of strikes through the years, but yet it was a good place to work. And all the years that I was in the tax preparation accounting business, I had never heard an employee complain about Goodyear, and I knew it was hard, dirty work.
Well, if you had to become a union member, wouldn't that have guaranteed your salary?
It would have, but I wasn't a union. I hired in management. Mm-hmm. The union workers were the ones who did the physical part, like building tires or making components or mixing up the rubber or processing the tires. But I wanted to be in management, so.
And your husband would have preferred that you not take the job?
Well, he had learned a few years earlier that I needed to work, so he supported me in me taking that job. But when I did go to work originally, he didn't want me to because he got accustomed to me having all of the work at home caught up.
And then you must have come home with stories. Did they upset him?
No, sir. I never carried my stories home.
When you never told him?
No. When I left work, I left my stories at the plant and had my home life. And then when I got back to the plant, I dealt with those.
You became a manager, and you write that many of the men that you oversaw had never answered to a woman before at work or at home. How did that affect your ability to do your job?
Well, I told them that I was there to be their gopher, so to speak. I'd make sure that their pay was proper and correct, and I'd make sure that when they wanted a day off, I'd have it scheduled if it was within my capabilities of doing that. And we were there to perform a job, which meant that I was to make sure they had the right schedule and the right components and everything they needed, and we would do the work and put out a good quality product, and we would have fun doing it, and we would also be safe, and no absenteeism and no accidents.
So, and how many of them went along with you on that? Because you did run into problems.
They were doubtful in the beginning, but when they saw that I would do my job and I didn't ask them to do it for me or to do any part of it, they started referring to me as Miss Lily, and I carried that title from the time I started until I left. And when I first hired in, I might volunteer while I was on the training program for some of the union work if I could do the job and keep up production. And they saw that I would work. And oftentimes, I might not understand completely why my hands were bleeding on the job or what was wrong. And they would come over and tell me, and they'd share their story and say, here's some tape. Tape up your hands. So they learned to respect me.
But not everyone. You seem to have been treated unfairly along the way. What about the incident that may have had the most lasting impact on you and your eventual legal battles over your it was over your supposed scrapping of $10,000 worth of tires. Well, what is that story all about?
Well, that story was when after they had moved me from one job to another, that there was not a job description or a P&P procedure book, and I had not had proper training. And they said I scrapped the tires, but now I never saw the tires. They never showed them to me. And the procedure, if you scrapped any tires, they should show them to you. So I think it was just something that was maybe more or less put on paper that really might not have happened. I can't say it did or it didn't, because personally I did not see those tires.
But it was damaging to you in the courts?
Not in the courts, no. No, not in the courts.
You also were once demoted essentially for refusing the sexual advances of one of the foremen. Did other women at the company have similar experiences? Did you talk about it?
They had similar experiences, too, but none of us were ever close together at the same time. I was on night shift. There were four crews. We ran 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I didn't come in contact with those people.
And did you ever go to management and say, this guy's giving me a hard time?
I did. And he said, well, we'll do an investigation. You go home. And I said, well, is the man going home? And he said, oh, no, he's staying. He's been here for 30 years. He's a great employee. I said, if he stays, I stay. Oh, we'll pay you. I said, that's not the situation here. I said, I want the same treatment he's getting. And so they did their investigation. In the meantime, people was taking the company side. The witnesses I had was going along with what the company wanted them to say, because they were in fear of losing their jobs. So what I did, I called up EEOC and asked them to file a charge, and they did.
Were you also carrying a knife to work to protect yourself? I mean, was it that?
Well, that was
early.
No, that was early on. I just put a pocket knife in my pocket, because the union people's jokesters, as far as the shift was concerned, they always picked the new people. That's picking off their pubic hairs. And they kept kidding me that they were going to do me. And I thought, no, I don't think so. So, and I'm on a night shift with not any other managers around. So, I did, but I always conducted myself in the professional mannerism, and I never was approached on that. I didn't have to carry that knife very long.
But still, the whole thing seems rather uncomfortable for anybody to have to go through. Do you think it would have been any better at some other similar plant, at Bridgestone or Michelin? Is this the culture of tire manufacturing?
I don't know. I can't say about that. All I know is where I was at. I can't tell you that. I don't know.
Uh-huh. So you went to the EEOC, right?
Right.
This because a coworker, his advantage became so disruptive that you say you were almost paralyzed when you thought of going to work.
Yeah, he said that if I did not go to bed with him and have sex with him, that I wouldn't have a job. And in my mind, I'm visualizing all of the college tuition bills that are coming due, and the mortgage is due every first of the month, and the utilities and food, and two children to have clothes and school expenses. And I'm visualizing all of this, and I can't afford to lose my job.
Well, yeah, there were no other jobs in the area?
But there were some other jobs, but they didn't pay as well as what Goodyear was paying at the time.
Although you didn't know that you were being paid.
Or the benefits.
My guest is Lily Ledbetter, who has written a memoir called Grace and Grit, My Fight for Equal Pay and Fairness at Goodyear and Beyond. So you heard about the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Somebody told you about it, or did you hear about it?
No, I came from H&R Block when I hired him with Goodyear as a district manager, managing 16 locations. So I had had thorough education and training in my background, and I was a professional manager, so I knew about Equal Employment Commission. I knew about labor law. I knew about all of those type different departments and the, what the law pertained and what and how it pertained to me.
But I'm sure you also assumed that you'd be protected as a result. It sounds to me like you were rather vulnerable.
No, I wasn't vulnerable, but what happened...
You were being ostracized.
Well, the plant had government contracts, so an individual like myself would assume that a big national employer would be adhering to all federal guidelines to keep those government contracts.
When did you discover the note that you say changed the course of your life? And what did it say?
It was in the later part of my career. It only had four names and our four base pay salaries per month. And it was such a drastic difference, and the lowest paid person had less seniority and less service and had only been with the company about a year at the time and transferred in to that job from a lower paying job, making 600 plus more a month than I did. And the first thing that was so devastating about that note, the first thing that went through my mind was all of those overtime hours that I had worked all of those years, and not gotten my proper payment for me and my family and how much my family had done without. And the next thing that occurred to me is this not only affects my pay today and in the past, but it affects my retirement, my contributory retirement, my 401k, and now in my retirement, my Social Security. That's why I am so passionate about what I do today, and I have to keep this fight going because women and their families, and this is not just a woman's problem. This is a family of problem.
You probably don't know who slipped you that note, but you
absolutely
received a number
not.
Of anonymous notes, didn't you?
I did.
Some of them you say serious, some not. But they, on the whole, they were in support of you. They were people who recognized that you were in an unfair situation.
That's true.
You say a few of them tipped you off that you were about to get blamed for something that didn't happen on your shift, or that another crew was trying to take credit for your production numbers.
That's true. They really did. And I will say in the early beginning of my career at Goodyear, which I knew upon entering the employment, that I would have to work harder and smarter and longer than my male counterparts and not ever make a mistake. I knew that. But still, in my early career, I'm sure my job was saved on two occasions when I got those notes.
Now, why do you think this institutional prejudice discrimination was in place here? Was that Goodyear coming up with this, or was it some person who was at the top level of management?
Well, it was basically, I think at the time there had been so few women there and none of them had ever been promoted or worked their way up. Most women who had those jobs did not continue. They would leave the company and go for another job. They were younger and they would look for better employment and they would leave. But I was there and hired in after I was 41, and I was going to plan on making that the ending career for me. And another thing, when you... The men sort of assume that, you know, they're going to promote this woman, whether she's capable or not. So the my co-workers, the peers in the same level positions, they were, you know, always downgrading or saying, I'm having to do her job, or I'm following her shift and she's not doing hers. And when I was in the mailroom for a couple of years, one of the dirtiest parts of the plant, I was put into the control room, what they call the glass house. The men complained and said, she's supposed to spend at least a year on the floor managing the operation on the floor before she can have that job. So my boss said, sorry, Lily, but I have to put you out on the floor. In other words, he did what the men, other men, suggested. And so that was really what brought this on.
Also, there's sometimes resentment that a woman is doing a job that a man could do because he's the person who's going to be supporting a family. Of course, you were helping support your family. Your husband argued with you about leaving for work on the day that you received that note that revealed just how much less you were being paid because you'd injured your knee in an accident at the factory, but you insisted on going to work that day despite the pain?
That's true. I went to work for 2 weeks with the knee pain, and a co-worker that was supposed to be showing me the equipment operation in the new job, he closed a hydraulic gate on my right knee.
Do you think that the pain affected the way you reacted to that note?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. The reaction to that note, I think anybody would have been devastated and humiliated over that note, because here I have worked for 19 years at that point and doing, and in the early 90s, I was handpicked as one of the four to start up the light truck radio division. And then in the 1995-6 era, I was given the top performance award.
So after you got the note, you went back to the EEOC to file a complaint, and you write that as you were talking to the officer there, you were struck by the ugliness you were describing. Was this the first time you were saying these things out loud? Because you said you didn't talk about them with your husband.
No, I didn't talk about this outside the plant. I always kept my job. You know, what happened at the plant stayed at the plant. And I believe that's the way it should be. You know, I just...
Well, some people will, decompress with a spouse because it's hard to keep it all in.
I'm not one of those people.
This was March 1998. How far back did your complaints actually go?
Probably to the early 80s.
And then it took more than...
That's when I filed the other charge to get my other job back.
And then it took more than 3 years for your lawsuit to go to court. By then, you had depleted your 401k?
I did that the first 2 years because I got forced out at age 60, and I could only draw my Goodyear retirement. I could not draw Social Security, so I pretty well depleted the 401k, surviving on the little retirement that I had for that period of time. I should not have signed and accepted the early out, but I did not have an attorney at the time I made that decision, and at that time was when my mother was dying with cancer, and I was an only child taking care of her and going to work too. And just the pressure of all, I made the wrong decision, and it was sort of like, you know, you hem an animal into a corner, they're going to come out fighting. And so basically I just made the wrong decision on that.
But then you did get a lawyer.
Well, after the equal employment called and said I had one of the best cases they had ever seen, but they were short of staffers and were backlogged, and I might want to get an attorney, and I found a young attorney in Birmingham, Alabama, with a large firm, and he had never lost a case. I did my homework on him, and I presented my story and evidence to him, and he took my case pro bono.
And your complaints were four counts under three laws, the Equal Pay Act, Title 7 of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and the Age Discrimination Employment Act as well.
That's true.
And you had a strong case in all of them.
Mm-hmm.
You write about the discomfort you felt throughout the whole process, particularly when your therapist was put on the stand. How did they even find out that you had a therapist?
Oh, well, my attorney was the one who called her.
Oh.
My attorney called her.
Did you feel that testimony was relevant to the case?
It should have been. She spent too much time on the personal part rather than on what had been created than the Goodyear part. And my attorney said later that she did not help us at all.
You were surprised to learn that several of the files about your job performance at Goodyear had disappeared.
Everything had disappeared. In fact, the judge asked for my personnel file. He asked specifically to one of the Goodyear officials where it was at, and he said, well, I think we burned those because the Gadsden plant was on the shutdown list, and we were burning files. And he said, let me explain the law to you folks, and directed his attention to the attorneys representing Goodyear. And he said, when an individual files a charge, a complaint, you are mandatory required to retain their records until that case is closed, no matter whether there's a plant there or not. And so there was not a file.
Well, it sounds like they were just coming up with some excuse for destroying your files.
Well, true.
My guest is Lily Ledbetter, who's written with the help of Lanier Scott, Isom, Grace and Grit, My Fight for Equal Pay and Fairness at Goodyear and Beyond. Lily Ledbetter is one of those rare people who actually has an act of Congress named after her. So what was the verdict of this initial lawsuit?
The jury came back, and I lost those other three, and I hated losing the age discrimination because I really wanted that one. But the jury found in my favor on the equal pay $3.8 million.
And then the verdict was overturned on appeal?
But first, the judge had to say had to explain to the court how I was only entitled to $300,000. There's a cap. My $3 million suddenly dropped to $300,000.
The cap was a state law?
No, it's federal. Mm-hmm. This is federal law. This is a federal case. It's a federal law that Congress put on, the United States Congress, in 1991. There's a cap that I was only entitled to $300,000. And then on back pay, your listeners need to know that women are only entitled to 2 years, as far back as the law allows you to go. I knew that going in. I didn't know about the cap, but I knew about the 2 years, and you can only go back 2 years. So the judge took that lowest paid male where I worked, and I left the courtroom on Friday afternoon with $360,000 award. And then Goodyear appealed 11th Circuit throughout. And then we appealed, and we were heard in the Supreme Court in November of 06. And the verdict came out the following May of 07. And when those five justices made that ruling in that case, it changed the law because the law was on my side. And when they made that ruling, it completely changed the law. And the Ledbetter Law, the Lily Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, changes the law back to where it was prior to the ruling.
So what did Judge Alito write in his opinion?
He said I should have filed my charge the first discriminatory paycheck I got.
But even, you didn't know that
even
you
though
been discriminated
I didn't know it,
against.
Even though I didn't know it. And what that would mean oftentimes that an individual, when they get a job, is when their pay is set. So their discriminatory paycheck might be set when they're hired.
Now, you talk about how illogical you thought Judge Alito's opinion was, but you also say you felt particularly betrayed by Justice Thomas. Why?
He's from the South. He's definitely a minority. He's definitely had a hard time through the years, and he should have interpreted the law like it was meant to be. That's why I'm so disappointed. But a lot of people tell me that Judge Thomas is sort of bitter. I don't know.
Well, Justice Ginsburg voiced her dissent on this.
Yes.
It was, do you think that she was in a unique position to judge this case as a woman and someone who is relatively similar in age?
Yes. Yes, I do. And she knows the law. She is a stickler for details and the law. And Justice Ginsburg said, these people don't understand what it's like in the real world. You can't go around the water cooler and discuss your pay. And when you work for a corporation like I did that tells you if you discuss your pay, you will not work here, then you cannot find out how much you're making and how you stand with your coworkers. In fact, there's not even a law that requires employers to post the top, the mid, and the bottom. When cost of living increases it, you may not know. You may not know that all your coworkers are walking around here with millions of dollars more money than you.
So it was really a matter of the statute of limitations being applied?
That was the technicality they used. But now the statute of limitations has always been, just like it is back today, based on the paycheck accrual rule. If you're still getting a check, which I was, the clock starts all over again. When you're getting that check, that starts the clock again. And so I was still getting a check, and I learned that I was being discriminated against in my pay simply because I was a woman.
So there was a major outcry, I remember, at the time.
Yes.
And did people from Congress come to you and say, we want to do something?
Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said to Congress, she challenged them. She said, the ball is in your court. That's part of her dissent. Maybe not word, but it's, she said, the ball is in your court. It's up to Congress to correct this and change the law back. And I was called and in Congress within 2 weeks.
And did you find friends and foes in Congress?
Oh, yes. I found them both. But you know, what we and I are talking about today, it has nothing to do with Republicans or the Democratic Party. This is a fundamental American right that people are paid fairly and equitable for American working families. And so, you know, I lobbied. I went to Washington and I toured that congressional building. I stayed in the House. I stayed in the Senate to gain support and explaining to every person why this is so critical and why we need this. And I testified twice before the House, twice before the Senate. This is so critical that and this will never do Lilly Ledbetter not one penny's worth of good.
President Obama, this is the first bill he signed as a president.
Yes, sir.
So that's
yes, sir. It's
also
memorable.
Interesting historically.
Yes.
But what finally happens here? There've been cases since, like Walmart versus Dukes. Were they able to apply the Lilly Ledbetter law?
No, because that's a different case. That's a whole different case. That was they were looking to be a class action, and mine was not class action. This is total. That's
so totally, that was thrown out because too many women were involved?
Well, that's totally different. They were trying to get it so they could, and the five justices on that case decided that the Walmart was too large around the world for that. But that's a whole different case, and I'm not familiar with the laws that pertain to them on that.
Your book provides advice for someone who wishes to file a complaint of employment discrimination.
Right.
And provides resources of organizations to get in touch with. Have you heard of any cases that have been brought successfully applying this law?
I have, and a lot of people. I heard a cab driver that was driving a cab and heard a discussion like your show today. And he didn't know about this, and he said, you know, I'm going to call up an EEOC and check on my pay, and he did, and he found out, he was a minority, that he got a lot of back pay because he was being discriminated against, and it helped him, and they helped him, and that helped his family. But
because this isn't just applied to women.
No, it's for minorities too, women and minorities.
What are you doing for a living these days? Can't go back to Goodyear.
Well, I'm 73. I'm retired, and I just scraped by because I lost my husband, as the book tells you, in 08. And what happens when the women in this country now, I have learned in my travels and speaking to groups that we're outliving our spouses by 10 years, and our income drops. Mine dropped at my house more than 50%, losing all of my husband's retirements. But my bills and my utilities and the cost of living has gone up, and my retirements will never change. So I am struggling in order to get by.
But you wrote this book.
We hope the book sells, right.
And the book is called Grace and Grit, My Fight for Equal Pay and Fairness at Goodyear and Beyond. It's one of those sad stories. You won the battle, whatever it is, mm-hmm. but you wound up losing anyway, unfortunately, on a technicality. Is there any way that can be redressed, or is
no,
it too late?
No, mine's gone forever. But you know, from the day I saw the note and I made the decision to go forward with this change in my life, it was never about the money, because in my case, that $360,000, had I got that money, the attorneys would have gotten 50%, and I had been warned I would have to pay federal and state tax on most all of it because it was in lieu of wages. I would have had less than $50,000 to carry home, and I'd already spent $35,000 of my own money in printing and gas and phone and different expenses in getting to it. And it took me 9 years from the time I filed the charge until I got the final verdict in my case. But I have been so blessed with the people I've met on my journey and the things that have occurred in my life. I have been so blessed, and I've had people to give me things and help me along the way that have made my life so rich.
Lily Ledbetter's book is written with the help of Lanier Scott Isom, I-S-O-M, the book Grace and Grit, published by Crown Archetype. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.